Culture Affidavit, episode 157, Batman, From Death to Dying. Hello and welcome to episode 157 of Pop Culture Affidavit, the podcast that takes a look at everything random in the world of popular culture, which is brought to you by the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Network. I'm your host, Tom Paneris. 2024 marks the 35th anniversary of the release of Batman, starring Michael Keaton and Jack Nicholson. If you were alive in 1989, you remember that summer was full of a lot of great movies and anticipated sequels, but Batman outdid them all, and that year was the summer of the Bat. It truly was. I mean, even now you can watch TV footage from that summer, and you'll see at least one Batman t-shirt on the screen, like when you stumble across an old clip from Club MTV or Dance Party USA or whatever show the teens were back into those days. I wouldn't know. I was still watching Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles in the afternoons and I didn't have cable anyway. But really, 1989 was huge. It was huge for Batman. Not only because of the movie, because it was the character's 50th anniversary. That's how we got books like Tales of the Dark Knight, Batman's First 50 Years by Mark Cadavaz. I covered that a few years ago, back in 2019, for the 50th anniversary of Batman. But in addition to that, the 50th anniversary and the movie, there's one other significant moment in 1989. On June 13th, DC published Batman number 436. Then on August 29th, Batman 440 was released. These two issues are significant because they kick off two big storylines in the Bat books, Year 3 and A Lonely Place of Dying. Furthermore, they are the first appearances of Tim Drake, who would go on to become the third Robin, putting on his costume as the new Boy Wonder at the end of Batman number 457, which came out in the fall of 1990. I thought about taking a look at these two storylines because they're significant, but I've done that before in other capacities. And if you really want some great coverage of the life and career of Tim Drake, go back and listen to Rob Meyer's podcast, Everyone Loves the Drake. I think it's still available over on the Batman universe. Tim is one of my favorite characters of all time, and his first full appearance in Batman 440, because his appearance in issue 436 is like a couple of panels of a flashback cameo from him witnessing the Grayson's death at Haley's Circus. So Batman 440 was among some of the first Batman comics I ever read as I started collecting comics in 1990. So what's interesting to me for this episode is the few issues of the main Batman title that came out immediately following a death in the family and right before Year 1 and right before Year 3. You know, kind of how like earlier this year I was interested in the Crisis Hangover from 86. So I wanted to see what happened in the Batman titles in this intermediary period between the big storylines of 1988 and 1989. How did Jason Todd's death resonate immediately afterward? How did the book do in the transition between Jim Starlin's run and Marv Wolfman's run? And yes, I'll also talk about Year 3 and A Lonely Place of Dying a little bit, because those were monumental for Batman as the character headed into the 90s. And I'll do all that after this. Stick around.
In 1987, a legend was reborn when George Perez and DC Comics recreated and relaunched Wonder Woman, helping bring some truth and understanding to the newly formed post-crisis DC universe. Between the bullets, the bracelets, angry gods, a new city, and a new supporting cast, Wonder Woman rejoined the never-ending battle for a more loving and peaceful way of life. Join me, Sean, and a bevy of all-star podcast guests on Peace Bound and Down, a Wonder Woman podcast, where we review each issue of the George Perez written and drawn Wonder Woman series and try to bring some peace to man's world each month. So find a little bit of paradise, only on the Fire and Water Podcast Network. What's so funny about peace, love, and understanding?
Oh, what's so funny about peace, love, and understanding? So the specific comic books I'm looking at here are going to be Batman, Volume 1, number 430, 431, and 432. I will take a quick mention of issues 433, 434, and 435. That's the three-part storyline, The Many Deaths of Batman. But I will be covering those other three more in depth. What won't be in here is Batman Annual 13, which I wanted to cover but don't have a copy of in any format, so I'm sorry. Legends of the Dark Knight, which would come out, which would debut until October of 1989, so it wasn't even out yet. And the issues of Detective, because those are still in continuity, but it seems like up until about a year or two after this, Detective and Batman were like really separate books. And that's not a knock, because there's still Batman stories, obviously. And Alan Grant is on Detective at this point, and his take on the character was different than what like Starlin and then Wolfman were doing in the main title. And honestly, the Grant Breyfogle run on Detective is really one of my top three Batman runs of all time. If you want to know the other two, by the way, there are the Englehart Rogers run from the late 70s and the Chuck Dixon Graham Nolan run on Tech from the 90s. But here's the thing. You didn't need to be reading Detective in order to fully understand what's going on in Batman. That wouldn't really start to happen until the 90s, and only then in varying capacities, because while Denny O'Neil's editorial run would see the books get really cohesive over, you know, kind of the three or four titles that were going. You know, at one point, I think it was Batman Tech, Shadow of the Bat, and Legends. And then there was a fifth, I think like a fifth week book, which I cannot remember what it was called. Maybe the Caped Crusader or something. That would be in the 90s. So the Nightfall and all the other crossovers and such. But here, like I said, they're separate. And then when they get cohesive, they never actually get as cohesive as like the Triangle era in Superman, because those really were a weekly story. In fact, for years after Nightfall, I actually only bought Detective, and I would only buy Batman if the book crossed over. Anyway, that's my long way of saying that these three issues are going to be the main focus of the episode. But let's just set things up a little bit with what came before. So Batman is retooled slightly after Crisis, with his pre-Crisis adventures ending with issue 400. Frank Miller and David Mazzucchelli, along with Mike W. Barr and Alan Davis, retell his origin in the Year 1 and Year 2 storylines in both titles. And after Year 1 ends, we get the reintroduction of Jason Todd in Batman 408. In this continuity, Dick Grayson was fired from his role as Robin after being shot by the Joker, and he would go on to become Nightwing. Months later, Batman discovers Jason stealing the tires off the Batmobile and eventually takes him in, adopts him, and trains him to be the new Robin. This Jason is different in attitude than his pre-Crisis version, as that version was in some ways more like the younger version of Dick Grayson that readers had known in the years before he was allowed to grow up. Here, Jason in the post-Crisis is rougher around the edges and impulsive, and this is what eventually gets him killed. In A Death in the Family, he flies off on his own to Ethiopia to find his birth mother. The Joker beats him to within an inch of his life with a crowbar, and then the Joker sets off a bomb that kills both Jason and his mother. Okay, well, the 1-900 pull and Rob Kelly killed off Jason Todd, but, you know what I mean. So in issue 428, Batman discovers Jason's dead body, takes him back to Gotham to be buried, and then tells Alfred that from this point on, he's going to work alone. New Titans 55, he reinforces this by getting into an argument with Dick Grayson over Jason's death, eventually punching Dick and kicking him out of the Batcave. It is actually really a great scene. It's done by Marv Wolfman, George Perez, and I think Bob McLeod? Either Bob McLeod or Romeo Tangal did the inks on that. So that issue 55, along with some pages and panels from another few other issues of New Titans, as well as Secret Origins Annual 3, will help seed some things for Year 3, as far as Nightwing is concerned. Now, Batman will go off on his own, and he and Superman will save the United Nations from the Joker, the Crown Prince of Crime, seemingly be killed in a helicopter crash in issue 428. We never did find the Joker's body, though, so, and we know he comes back. But anyway, the Joker's pretty much out of the picture for the better part of a year, pretty much for the better part of a year or two. He comes back in Detective 617, Batman 450, and Batman 451, which are 1990. So they took him out of the books for a little while there. So at that point, we are at Batman 430. Batman 428, he discovered the body. The Joker gets quote-unquote killed or goes missing in Batman 429. And now Death in the Family is over, and we have Batman 430, which comes out on December 20th, 1988, with a cover date of February of 89. The cover is by Frederick Butler and shows Batman creeping along a rooftop against the pink hue of a sunset, and the copy reads, "Somewhere below, there lurks a madman with a rifle and a secret that Batman dare not face. Somewhere below is the fatal wish." Now, there's no title on the inside of the book, but we're going to use that as the title. The cover is more of a poster slash pinup-like cover than having anything to do with the story, and I really like it. Frederick Butler, according to Mike's Amazing World, has three comic book credits, and they're all from around this time. And it would have been interesting to see him do a whole story. Instead, our creative team on this is the one that's been with us for a few years now at this point. Jim Starlin's writing. This is his very last issue of his Batman run, by the way. Pencils are by Jim Aparo, inks by Mike DiCarlo, John Costanza letters, Adrian Roy colors. This art, letter, and color team would be the same on the next two issues as well. We begin in a Gotham City office building at 5:10 p.m., just as people are leaving the office for the night. A man named Tim Conrad enters a building, blows off a coworker who greets him cordially, and gets into an elevator. He takes that all the way up and goes onto the roof. He opens his briefcase, assembles a high-powered rifle, and then starts shooting at people on the street below, killing several of them. 40 minutes later, the police have cordoned off the building, and Commissioner Gordon is telling Batman what's going on. Tim Conrad has recently been fired from his job. There's a woman trapped on the street, and the police can't move in lest they make the situation worse. Batman says he'll go after the sniper and occupy him so that the police can get the woman to safety, and then he'll take care of him. Gordon asks if Robin is with him, and Batman quietly says no. When Gordon asks if something is wrong, Batman says no again and heads toward the building. He draws the sniper's fire that buys the police enough time to get the woman to safety. Batman heads into the building and up to the roof. The sniper starts firing at him before he can open the roof access door and then yells that he's going to check out of this lousy life, but before he does, he's going to take out as many people as possible and screamed, "I wish you were all dead." Batman mutters that phrase to himself and then heads down to the upper floor office of O'Neill and Rasper, creative consultants, opens a window, and begins to climb up the side of the building. Over the course of the next 7 pages, as he climbs the building and confronts the sniper, we get a flashback to Bruce's childhood, when his father got angry at him and slapped him, and Bruce wished that he was dead. Then after they made up, his parents took Bruce to the movies to see Zorro. They decided to walk home, and you all know what happens. On the rooftop, Batman charges at Conrad, dodging his fire and then throwing some smoke pellets at him. When Conrad's view is obstructed, it's time for Batman to take him out, but he misses his punch, almost gets shot, and in a daze afterward falls. Both men are near the edge of the roof, and at this point Batman tells Conrad to step back, but it's too late because a police sharpshooter takes him out, and he falls off the roof to the ground below. As Batman looks over the remains of the scene, the words from his memory, "I wish you were dead," linger, along with the apology he gave back then, "I'm sorry, Daddy. I didn't mean it." You know, sometimes after huge storylines, comic book titles have quieter stories or some sort of other story that gives the readers room to breathe. Sometimes it's because there's a guest creative team. Other times there's just an actionless issue where the characters take time to grieve or regroup. Now, Batman's not the type of character to always do that. And him being driven to continue his war on crime, despite what happened, is in character. But instead of an elaborate villain story here, Starlin just writes a very simple issue with a singular criminal and situation, and it really works. The opening is largely silent, instead of using thought balloons or long-winded narration boxes, and that establishes the tension right away. The actual confrontation is straightforward. It's a solid one-and-done story as well. And what makes this a little bit better than your average one-and-done is that the flashback Batman has in the middle of his encounter, as well as the brief moment where Robin is mentioned. You know, by the time we get to the beginning of A Lonely Place of Dying, Batman has become more and more violent and careless and is starting to fall apart. Here, though, which I would say is just after a death in the family, he's got a better handle on keeping it together and more or less avoiding thinking about what happened. In other words, he tamps down the emotions and throws himself into his work. But then Kanye drilling that he wishes they were all dead triggers, no pun intended, something in Bruce. And look, we've all seen the Waynes get gunned down how many times at this point? But here it works because Starlin seems to be trying to show the ways that trauma can almost spontaneously intrude when you least expect it. Having this memory come up completely throws him off and pretty much gets the other guy killed. But having a power draw Batman as stoic in the aftermath gives the end of the story the pathos it needs. Speaking of art, it's really good. You know, I've always liked Aparo and DiCarlo as an art team. They really are the definitive Batman art team of the late 80s. Norm Breyfogle a year or so later would draw some of my favorite Batman stories and really put a look to the character that has never really been duplicated. But that I was associated with like the early 90s and not the late 80s. I'm splitting hairs here. Anyway, Breyfogle and his art and how good it is does not take away from how good Aparo and DiCarlo were on the story. They're very straightforward as far as classic superhero art, but they also show some restraint that the issue needs by also having the ability to do bigger supervillain stories when they need to. There's a lot of silence in this issue. It really showcases the two artists' strengths. Credit to Adrian Roy, by the way, for giving the Bruce flashbacks a yellow and orange hue before making the murder black and red. That, alongside the regularly colored confrontation on the rooftop, makes for both scenes pop. Now, with Starlin gone, Christopher Priest, who at this time was going by James Owsley, writes the two issues after this. The rest of the creative team is the same. The cover for issue 431 is by George Pratt. It shows Batman hanging upside down off a large tree branch, his cape drooping beneath him. Again, it's more of a poster/pinup cover. It's really good, though, especially since there is a full moon bats in a gray background. And with the yellow title and yellow and black DC bullet mimic his costume. It's pretty cool. Pratt did a number of really cool Batman covers during this time, and I'll say that they're a bit underrated, especially since you've got covers in the 1989 to 1991 period by Michael Golden, Mike Mignola, and Norm Breyfogle. In fact, I'm one of the opinion that this 89 to 91 period was underrated for a very long time. I'm glad to see it get more love in recent years. The story in issue 431 is titled The Wall. It opens up with a flashback to 10 years ago when Bruce Wayne had traveled to North Korea to seek guidance from a master named Kirby. We are then back to the present where Batman is hanging from the ladder of a fire escape retrieving the tapes of a wiretap that he's kept on the phone of a crook named Ralph Stewart. He regrets that Stewart turned himself in so he couldn't beat a confession out of him. And then before he heads off and thinks that he being able to slap a criminal around will help him stop thinking about Jason and maybe even help get some sleep. Back at Wayne Manor, Bruce does attempt to rest, although laying on your bed in your Batman costume can't be the most comfortable thing in the world. And he's interrupted by Alfred, who tells him that the tapes have some very disturbing things on them. Batman heads to Gotham State Penitentiary and that night to confront Stewart. He plays the tape for him, which has Stewart mentioning that he witnessed some sort of hit, and it's obvious that he turned himself in because that way he'd feel more protected in jail than out on the streets. And Stewart won't say anything, And when Batman confronts him in solitary, he only says that he can't tell him because, quote, they'll kill me. Batman gets his hits in and then he leaves. What we know is that Stewart witnessed a woman getting murdered in an apartment. So Bruce dresses up as a building super to gain access to that apartment, which he does. Of course, he has to shake off the old lady down the hall. Her knees are sink fixed. So Bruce inventories the apartment, telling Alfred, who is in his ear the whole time, everything he is able to discern about the woman who lived there. He then tells him that he'll be back in the Batcave in about an hour or so after he fixes the sink. They don't have much of a lead there, except that they seem to be related to various Jane Does, one of whom is in L.A., and has been killed in a very odd way. The next night, we're in Gotham. Batman kidnaps a blonde woman who has been watching television, then confronts a mobster named Muggs Clifford, telling him that he's figured out how that woman in L.A. died by a technique called a vibrating palm, which is associated with the League of Assassins. We also find out that Batman kidnapped a federal attorney who's going after Muggs for racketeering, so it's more likely to protect her, and he implies that he knows Muggs obviously wants to put a hit out on her. When Batman leaves, Muggs calls off the hit, which Batman hears through a wiretap. Who ends up dead? Thaddeus Gladden. This was the guy Muggs was calling, a middleman between the League of Assassins and clients. Batman shows up to the mansion, finds the body, confronts the four assassins who took him out, and takes out three of them before confronting the fourth using the vibrating hand. He takes him out, but he does not kill him, and calls the police to take care of the assassins. Several days later, Batman stands outside of Kyrgyz Temple in North Korea. He reprimands Kyrgyz for training the League of Assassins, and when Kyrgyz shows no remorse, Batman leaves. So here we have a story that harkens back to the Batman of the 70s. Denny O'Neil would write him as taking on assassins, sometimes in international settings, as well as some as, and this all kind of reminds me a little bit of Frank Miller's Daredevil, too. And just like the previous issue, it's a tight one-and-done story. I've always enjoyed Christopher Priest's writing. I liked his run on Steel in the 90s. I've enjoyed some of his Green Lantern stories from around this time. So I was interested to see his take on Batman. He shows that he knows the character. He also does a good job at keeping the thoughts of Jason going and showing a little bit of what it's doing to him. We see him angry. We see him wanting to really take his rage out on the criminal underworld. And we see him a little more forceful with his approach. I mean, it's not like Batman's a puppy, but you can tell it slightly more than what he usually does. The showcase of the issue is the fight with the assassins. It's seven silent pages drawn by Aparo and DiCarlo, with the silence breaking when the final assassin notes that Batman used the vibrating hand technique and that he's obviously studied with Master Kyrgyz. It's just great. It reminds you of how well Aparo drew fight scenes. There's a great few panels of Batman wielding a frying pan. The fight with the last guy is right out of a kung fu movie where they just rush at one another. We don't know who's won until they've passed. They all do a lot of this in the issue, and it makes it seem like completely effortless, by the way. So again, just a really, really good one and done story. Not a profound change in the character, but really good action and a really good callback to a past era of the Dark Knight. The final story I've got is issue 432. Now, that cover is by M.D. Bright and Steve Mitchell, showing Batman fighting some guys in suits holding guns in a burning building. The cover text says, and if he gets past the FBI? Out of the three covers, this has the most to do with the story. It's also the most dynamic. Aparo and DiCarlo are still the art team on the issue, but it would have been interesting to see Bright and Mitchell do the entire comic. I really like the cover. I like M.D. Bright's work. I've seen him do a couple of Batman issues. I think he does number 423 and 424. He does at least one of the issues or two of the issues right around the time before Death in the Family. And I loved his Green Lantern, so I would really interested to see how he would do Batman. Anyway, the title is called Dead Letter Office. Creative team, same as the prior issue. We open on night in Gotham where Batman is entering an open window, and that open window is for an office. He notes that there are large footprints on the newly vacuumed carpet, and he heads toward a closet where a guy with a gun is hiding. Except it's not a guy, it's a blonde woman, and she's not a criminal. She's Maxine Kelly, and she's a private investigator. She was investigating the same guy, Marshall Rieger, a slimy lawyer. She can't get anything from the guy's files. Maxine returns home to find Batman waiting there. The case she's looking into is what has been deemed cold. Josh Winston was a child cat kidnapped 7 years prior. The suspect was named Saunders, and while he was arrested, he eventually got off. The mother, Tina Winston, has hired 6 private eyes. Maxine is the latest. Rieger was Saunders' defense attorney, so she's looking for Saunders because she's sure that getting through him will get to Josh. Batman doesn't get it. Why is she taking such a cold case? So she takes him to Gotham General Hospital, where Tina is laying in bed and she's very close to death. So Maxine promises that she'll find Josh before Tina dies and makes it clear that she's helping her because she honestly could not turn a case down from a dying mother. And then she asks Batman, do you have any idea what it feels like to lose your own son? And Batman walks silently away. Later in Commissioner Gordon's office, Jim's going over a case they've been working on. It's a jewel heist investigation, and they've been working on this case for the past 6 months. Batman's not really interested in the case, and he brings up Josh Winston. Gordon doesn't know why he's so interested in this case that's gone cold, because the kid's obviously dead, right? But Batman asks about Saunders. Jim says that the guy is living under an assumed name. He doesn't have access to it, and this means he's going to have to deal with the feds. Batman disguises himself as a firefighter. He uses smoke canisters to fake a fire in the federal building so it gets evacuated. The fire department responds to the alarm, and so he knows he has 12 minutes to pick the lock to the safe where the information on Saunders' whereabouts is kept. As he is doing so, an FBI officer who didn't evacuate the building is investigating the floor to see what's going on. He opens the door, and before he can say much of anything, he's hit with the foam of a fire extinguisher. Batman gets what he needs and heads downstairs, but is then met by 2 more feds who see his smoke canisters. They tell him he's under arrest, and Batman pulls out 2 smoke pellets from his utility belt because he's wearing it under the firefighter's coat, and then grabs one of the officer's guns and shoots out the light. He runs, fights with more agents, and eventually makes his way onto the roof. He finds a place to throw a batarang with a cable and swings away. He brings what he grabbed back to the Batcave. He still needs to decode it in order to read what's on a film. He calls Gordon in the middle of the night, asking what's up, and then asking for the code. Jim says it's a line Batman knows he can't cross, and asks why this case is so important, and Batman just hangs up on him. 3 days later, at St. Mark's Church in Boston, a priest enters a confessional. He sits down, and someone starts telling him that he knows he's Willie Saunders and mentions Josh Winston. Saunders says he's innocent. He swears he had nothing to do with the kidnapping. Batman throws his hands through the confessional screen and goes after Saunders. The next night, on the rooftop of Gotham Police Headquarters, Gordon lectures Batman about the Winston case. Batman's been ignoring the jewel heist, and he spent all this time going after Saunders to reach the conclusion that Saunders actually is innocent. Gordon also says that Josh Winston looks like so many other kids. Finding him is going to be impossible, but Batman says that's it, and leaves in his usual fashion. 40 minutes later, he's in Maxine's house. He tells her he needs her help, and he takes her to the Batcave. Batman tells her that when Gordon mentioned that Josh looked like any other kid, he ran his description through the FBI files, coming up with 3 dozen names. He looked through several other databases and sets of files, including pictures taken at the 4th of July celebration from which Josh was kidnapped. In one of the photos, everyone's looking up at the fireworks. Someone behind Josh appears to be looking right at him. Maxine thinks Batman's nuts until he shows her that the computer has come up with a match. Now, he can't be sure he's right, but his theory is that Josh was kidnapped by this woman whose son had disappeared 10 years ago and was never found. Now, not only that, Josh looked just like him. So they go to the house. They ring the doorbell. And the woman opens, saying, do you have any idea what time it is, before realizing Batman is standing in front of her. She breaks down crying, and her son comes to the door to ask her why she's upset. That morning, Maxine brings Josh to see his mother. She cries out and hugs him, and later on, Batman tells Gordon that Tina Winston died shortly afterward. Josh had no idea who she was. Gordon says the police cracked the jewel heist without Batman. He apologizes for second-guessing him on the missing persons case. Batman says that luck had more to do with his solving it than anything. Jim says he's about to call it a day and then asks, "You never answered my question. You know, why this kid?" With his back turned to Gordon, Batman looks at a photograph of Robin, and then he takes off. This is an outstanding detective story. It feels like an episode of a television series. We have a few characters for whom this is their only appearance. It's no big deal because they're, by the time they're on the page, a priest that makes them matter. I feel like Maxine, the female PI with enough guts to talk back to Batman and how she has these convictions about finding Josh, even though it's really a long shot. I like her. And I like how when Batman learns the reason why and understands, Gordon asks Batman the same questions that he more or less asked Maxine. I think that even the average civilian, when shown a cold case that's more of like a half decade old, would make the same assumption that Gordon does. Like, the probability is that the kid's dead, long dead, so you're looking for a body. And I like how it takes Jason's death for Batman not to be blasé about that missing persons case. In fact, he's reminded of Jason more than once. I'm sure that Christopher Priest was a fill-in for these two issues because they're both one-and-done stories, but I wish I would have seen him do a little bit more Batman. Maybe even get a run on one of the other titles at some point. So as it stands, he has these two issues, the 89 annual, not really that much, a special here and an issue there. Felt like he understood the character. He really would have done a great job with a case of the week type of Dark Knight detective book. As with the last two issues, we see Batman doing detective work, but also trying to deal with his grief, whether that be through anger or determination. What else makes this a really good story is that the investigation does take a couple of turns. It's through deduction and, yes, luck, that they more or less stumble upon the kid's whereabouts. I mean, a good chunk of the issue is taken up chasing a red herring. I think it's brilliant because it shows the hero fight having to fight to get what ultimately ends up being nothing. It sidesteps the way these stories go sometimes, which is that Batman leans on someone and does get the information he wants before busting through a window to apprehend him. Priest has action and fisticuffs in the issue while Batman's tracking down Saunders, but the true crime solving and drama of the issue takes place in a simple setting with a simple task, looking at pictures in the Batcave. The moment at the end is poignant, although I'm not sure what happens to either Josh or the woman who kidnapped him. You know, while driving to her house, Maxine tells Batman that what he did and what evidence he has will not hold up in court. And he just says, "I know." So I'm assuming that he actually allowed the woman to basically be free. Josh had no idea who this person was, so he does get taken back to his house, and it's going to be up to, quote, mom to eventually tell him who that was and how she got to be his, quote, mom. I want to say that's kind of what's going to happen. It's a little weird because she kidnapped a three-year-old. I guess it doesn't matter in the context of wrapping the story up, though. Imagine that, like, later on in his teen years, like, Josh finds out, and, like, that moment, like, face on the milk carton and all that. I mean, that's an interesting story to write. Anyway, the art, solid again. If I have one criticism, Josh is drawn by Jim Aparo when he's younger to look a little older than his age in the picture because he's at three. I mean, again, splitting hairs, no big deal. Because the art team can do action really well, but they also do quiet moments and pathos really well. And we've seen that in A Death in the Family. We saw that in issue 430, and we see it here. Now, the next three issues of Batman would be a three-part storyline called The Many Deaths of Batman. It's written by John Byrne, drawn by Aparo and DiCarlo. At this point, Byrne had, like, left the Superman books and was back over at Marvel on his West Coast Avengers run, and that would go on for a few years. He'd returned to DC in the 90s, had a couple of lengthy runs on titles like Wonder Woman and New Gods, but these are the only three issues of the main Batman series that he ever wrote. The story itself doesn't seem to need to be any part of any continuity at the time. The Many Deaths of Batman centers around a series of murders where all the victims were found wearing a Batman costume. It is a good storyline. It's a good, like, serial killer piece. It's a good mystery, but I didn't want to cover it because Jason's death really doesn't come up. And actually, this kind of feels like a fill-in, like a special that could have been put really more or less anywhere. And maybe it had been arranged for a while earlier, or that maybe Byrne had good feelings toward Denny O'Neill while he was kind of leaving DC behind, so he wrote Batman for a few issues. I don't know what went on behind the scenes here. But it's basically a placeholder. Marv Wolfman's run begins in 436 with the beginning of year three, and he would go on to write Batman and then Detective for a little less than 2 years alongside Grant and Breyfogle's work. And he and Grant and Breyfogle really laid the groundwork for both who Tim Drake would eventually be, and Chuck Dixon took that up in spectacular fashion in both the Robin miniseries and then the ongoing in the 90s. And they also would really lay the ground for what Batman would become throughout the decade. They introduced Tim Drake, like I said. They bring Nightwing back into the fold for a little while, because if you think about it, Nightwing had been exclusively in the Titans. There was a Teen Titans spotlight issue where he was teaming up with Batman. There's Batman 416, where he doesn't team up with Batman, but he teams up with Jason. So it's one of my favorite issues of all time. If you ever get the chance to read Batman 416, go read it. It's so good. But other than that, post-crisis, Dick's not really in the book as Nightwing until you hit Marv's run. And then he's in year three quite a bit. He's essentially like the protagonist of year three, more or less. And then in A Lonely Place of Dying, of course. And while he's still with the Titans throughout the early part of the 90s and in through Nightfall, once the quests go on and the Night's End comes around, he leaves the Titans and becomes part of the Bat family again for true. And Chuck Dixon, again, handles his character through the ongoing series in the late 90s. This is kind of like where we're seeding it. I like the fact that, you know, we get in this time, we've had Robin killed and then reintroduced within a year or two of just the concept and built up to the true reintroduction of Robin, which was one of the best executed things I've ever seen in a comic. It's just so well done. And you could, and apparently, like, you could tell that the fans were really, really behind it, because it was just so, we all knew that Tim was going to be Robin. It was just a matter of time. And the stories that led up to it were just outstanding. And they really did a great job with him. I mean, he was Robin in the Robin costume for, almost 20 years before Damian came along. I might be off by five or so, but you know what I mean. But this little period, these three issues, it's this little snapshot. How do you deal with the immediate aftermath of such a huge event in the Dark Knight's career? He has to keep going. The book has to keep going. And I think it lays some ground for the mess he is at the beginning of A Lonely Place of Dying, as well as through much of year three. And I really, really enjoyed these three issues. I think they've been traded in the Cape Crusader trades that were out a few years ago. They're all three of them are up on DC Infinite. I've never actually tried to find them individually. I know years ago I read something, it might have been a Mile High Comics catalog, or an Overstreet price guide, that 430, I think, had like a low print run or something. It was, for some reason, it was like really, it was higher in cost back on the back issue market than most of the other books that were not Death in the Family from around that time. And I think it had to do with a low, like a under ordering or something like that. I wish I had the annual. I'm going to see if I can find it and read it, because I'm kind of curious about that. But yeah, so I recommend going and reading them. They're really quick reads, and you'll just enjoy some classic Batman stories. And that really will do it for this episode. Next month, toward the end of September, will be my annual Baltimore Comic Con episode. Brett is going to come with me. We have VIP passes. It's because it's their senior year in high school, and this may be one of their last shows with me for at least a while. So we sprung for the VIP passes. So what's that experience like? What do you get? All the swag, that sort of stuff. Come back here and find out. Until then, check out the blog for new posts. Follow me on social media. I'm on Blue Sky, by the way, as Pop Aff, P-O-P-A-F-F, just like Twitter. And I have a Pop Culture Affidavit has a Instagram account as well. I'll eventually update the ending credits with this stuff when I get around to it. So check me out over there. I am still doing the Twitter and the Facebook page is still up, but more over on Blue Sky than Twitter these days. And when I remember to update the Insta, I update the Insta. So there you go. But until then, thank you very much for listening and take care. Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Affidavit, which is produced by me, Tom Panarese. All clips are copyright their respective copyright holders and no infringement is intended. This podcast is a part of the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Network, which you can find at twotruefreaks.com. If you like the show, please leave a review on Apple Podcasts. It helps the show get noticed by other people. Feedback via email can be sent to popcultureaffidavit@gmail.com. For show notes and essays and other things random in the world of popular culture, visit popcultureaffidavit.com. You can also follow this show on Facebook at facebook.com/popcultureaffidavit and on Twitter at popaff. That's P-O-P-A-F-F. Thanks for listening and come back next time for more pop culture randomness.